All right, everyone, let's get the show started. Welcome to our DevOps Office Hours. It's March 24th, 2021. My name is Eric Osterman, and I'll be leading the conversation. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator, and that means that we help companies own their infrastructure in record time by building it together with your team while showing them the ropes. If that sounds interesting, head over to cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. Again, that's cloudposse.com/quiz to get started. For those of you new to the call, the format is very informal. My goal is to get your questions answered, so feel free to unmute yourself at any time if you want to jump in and participate. If you're tuning in from our podcast or YouTube channel, you can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/office hours. We host these calls every week. We'll automatically post a video recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you enjoy our content and want to support our channel, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. We'll also follow up with an email so you can share it with your team. So with that said, let's kick it off. I got some light announcements today. First one is some geodesic improvements. We've talked about this a fair bit. Geodesic is core to our whole strategy at Cloud Posse, following SuiteOps. And geodesic is this cloud automation shell, or it's essentially just a Docker toolbox. Toolboxes are getting more and more popular. And the improvements that we have here are just to the usability. We got to some much needed updates here to make it easier to use. So on your computer, if you want to follow along, it's super easy to just get started with geodesic now. You just start a shell. You'd run Docker run, for example, and the Docker image, so cloudposse/geodesic, and then the release. I'm just going to go with the latest and the distribution, which is going to be Debian in this case. So running this command, it's just going to give me a hint what I need to do. How do I keep going? If I wanted to just really quickly kick the tires, and I can just add IT for an interactive TTY, interactive terminal, and now I'm dropped into a shell. Now I have everything from Terraform to Helm file, Terra Grunt, if it floats your boat, everything. Ships inside this container. Plus we have all the Cloud Posse packages there. Now, when you just run it this simple way that I did here, there's nothing mounted to the file system. I'd have to do that all manually. And this is where it gets kind of tedious to add all these arguments to your shell, like volume mount, $home to localhost, and other arguments you might pass. So that's why what we have is this. So if you just run the same command in it, it outputs a initialization script here with a hint here on what to do next. So to get started with that, I would run this and pipe bash that. And then I can just run geodesic anytime I want to use geodesic. So that was pretty easy, right? I'm in a shell, I can type /localhost, it mount to my home directory. Now I have a full way I can develop in my IDE locally. I can be in this container and operate with these commands on those things. And since it's a Docker image, I can run that Docker image in my GitHub Actions. I can run that Docker image with Spacelift. I can run that Docker image with Circle or Codefresh or any other system like that. Any questions? All right.
I have one.
All right.
Andrew. I noticed you have AWS Vault in there. We've had some trouble doing that with our we call our version of geodesic Anvil. And we've had some trouble trying to do AWS Vault inside Anvil. And so what we do is we say AWS Vault exec whatever, you know, and then Anvil.
So The trick is, and this is, by default we don't set these here, but what you want is so AWS Vault. So when you do things inside a container, you're standardizing or normalizing on Linux, presumably, and it's in a VM ultimately. So AWS Vault, for those not familiar with it, what is it, by Segment.io, is it?
It is a lovely, beautiful, amazing tool. Continue.
Yeah. Oh no, this is actually
no.
Not.
It's 99 designs.
So this is a tool that just makes it easier to securely manage your AWS profiles. It helps you assume roles. It helps you work with AWS SO, and it supports a keychain. Now, keychains is a concept, right? So you have OS X keychains. Windows presumably has its own concept of that. Linux has its keychains. But the lowest common denominator is a file. So if users are trying to use AWS Vault natively on their workstation as much as they're trying to use AWS Vault within a container like Anvil, what you're using, or Geodesic, you need to use the lowest common denominator for that. And then you need to export the AWS Vault backend so that it's specified as a file. So they support encrypted files, and that's what's gonna work if you use AWS Vault in a container, as well as using AWS Vault natively.
Got it. Yeah, we've never tried to do that. We always just have it in the macOS keychain.
Yeah, so it's a trade-off, right? Like, it's a much better UX using the OS X keychain, but there's no way to access that from inside the Docker VM or the Docker image.
Yeah. Yeah, we just pass, there's four environment variables. There's like access key, secret key, token, or whatever, you know, and we just pass those in.
So
Docker compose file.
Yeah, and it's probably going to, it's for your company and whatnot, probably makes perfect sense to move that outside of Geodesic and just run AWS Vault natively and pass that into the container. The main reason for us being so strict on this and having it in the containers, we're trying to keep every single tool other than Docker in the container. So all you need to get started is literally Docker on your machine.
Yeah, no, this is better. Like, we didn't try the encrypted file thing, but I want to look at that now.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. And especially if you need to switch credentials within the container in your way, you would have to stop
the container,
run AWS Vault
in.
Again and do it again. Yep. Yeah. So that's a giant pain if you're swapping among accounts a bunch of times too. Yeah.
Cool. Any other questions on Geodesic or the toolbox pattern? All right. Well, same story goes here. We are definitely hiring for DevOps contractors. If you're working a lot with Kubernetes, Terraform, AWS, we really want to talk with you. Please don't be intimidated by us. We do a lot of rad stuff, but we don't exclusively work with geniuses. We work with ambitious people who know what they're doing and want to learn. So if that sounds interesting, you love open source, you're looking for something new, please do reach out to us. I'd like to talk with you. Other news. I was really hoping this was going to be able to be a formal announcement. Matt Galley's been working on some really rad documentation for how to get started with Atmos and Stax. We'll probably get this merged in the next day or so. And we're going to be sticking all of our tutorials in Cloud Posse tutorials, so you can check that out and run through them, as well as following up with some documentation on our documentation portal. So as soon as we release this here, you'll be able to follow a step-by-step plan for how to use Atmos and get started with it by using the tutorials. So we have a very simple example here that you can try out locally. It doesn't require AWS. It doesn't require a managing state so that you can see the value that it delivers. So Matt, maybe next week when we after we get this merged, we should also probably just do a live quick demo of some of this to show how easy it is in just a few minutes to get started with it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. It's really, you know, pretty simple. The demo could be, you know, 5-10 minutes and questions. So yeah, yeah, happy to do it.
Yeah, I think we should do that. That'd be cool. All right. Cube conform. This was just something Zach dropped in the channel here. This was gonna see. It looked kind of cool as a way to validate your Kubernetes manifests. I don't know. Well, okay, so one thing that is nice is that it supports JSON schema, and then you can create libraries of JSON schemas to validate your specific usage of Kubernetes manifests. So
should be able to cover like CRDs and things like that as well.
Yeah.
Kind of nice.
Yeah, so we've been diving into JSON schema a little bit, even with Cloud Posse's Atmos. And while we aren't immediately leveraging it right now, we have our this is the JSON schema that we've now defined for Atmos in our stack configuration. So JSON schema is very very cool, and I think it's a cool application of using it here for kubeconform. So now I get it. All right. Next announcements is, we have a couple Terraform modules that are coming out very soon for managing Cloudflare zones and WAF. So just more things coming in under the ecosystem here. All right, let's move on to Q&A and talking points. I think I'm going to move this here. All right, so the first question we have, this came from Andy, our own internal project manager. We have a challenge that we have here at Cloud Posse. You know, we move very quickly. We have a lot of pull requests open, in our case, across a lot of repositories and even organizations. So how do companies prioritize code reviews so that these things don't pile up, and also so you don't block developers from moving forward? This is an open-ended question. What are some things you guys have seen to improve the velocity of code reviews? What are your recommendations?
Some of the stuff I know you guys do already, like Mergify.
Mergify. Automatically merge the pull request that you can. Automate some of the common things like, hey, please rebase this.
Yeah,
that certainly helps on the automation side. I guess let's focus more. Well, okay. There's also like what is it? ReviewDog. It's interesting. I've seen. I don't know much about them. Vlad, are you on the call?
I am on the call. Yes, and I actually have a
pull request. Dude. Okay. Perfect. This was not intended, but it's perfect because I saw you contributing to some stuff here. Maybe you can redo it. Do you think ReviewDog could help Cloud Posse out?
Yes, but not in the way that you expect. So this is the official ReviewDog repository. Could you go to your organization? There is a ReviewDog Terraform. That's going to be the easiest example to see because it's relevant to the people on the call.
Yeah.
Oh, not Terraform. Sorry. TFLint. I'm a dum-dum. That's it. Action TFLint. So basically, and if you can scroll to the screenshots, there are some screenshots. That's it. So what a ReviewDog is it basically takes the output from linting tools. There are standards for how linting tools output their findings, be it JSON or, I know, it's a Vim standard something. ReviewDogs basically gets the output from linting tools, processes it, and then sends it to GitHub. Sends it to GitHub in a very easy way. That means it sends it, as you can see here, as GitHub checks or GitHub reviews on the pull request. That means that instead, okay, so let me give a bit of context. You have a couple of options. The first option, which is the most complex, is using something like CircleCI to run specifically TFLint. If you do that, you're just going to see, congratulations, the TFLint CircleCI run failed. Good luck. So you have to click on that. You have to click on the CircleCI link. You have to log into CircleCI in a new tab because it's never logged in. You have to find the workflow and you finally get to see the output. It's very, very annoying, especially because CircleCI doesn't update their GitHub app. So you can have the logs right there in the GitHub UI and forces you to context switch. And that is very annoying for me. But I am going too much. The second option would be to just run tflint in a GitHub action. That would be slightly better. You would see that the check failed and the developer would basically have to click on the check that failed and would see the output there. The friendlier option would be to run something like tflint review.doc action. And then you would just be on the pull request and you would suddenly get a review or a comment on the pull request saying, hey, this instance type is not a valid value, as you can see in the screenshot. That helps with context switching. Everything is on the PR. I love this because, again, it makes it very easy to implement all these tools, all these best practices. TFLint is given here as an example. There's also a TFSec action that I kind of have to upgrade, to be honest with you. There are actions for HadoLint, which is linting Docker files. That is very, very helpful, especially for developer teams that are newer to containers. If you're not familiar, HadoLint is basically a linter and best practice tool for Dockerfile. Basically like, hey, use tagged images. Hey, don't use root and all that. And just giving this input is basically forcing teams to do best practice. And I love it because it's an easy way and it's right there where the developers are working, be they software developers or infrastructure developers.
So codifying your expectations of things that can be done perhaps through static analysis, directly commenting on the lines that are violating that, and basically trying to get as much of this automated as possible through these tools so that when a human comes along and looks at it, it's basically perfect. And they can just comment on strategically what you're doing as opposed to like best practices.
Yep, I'm actually working on a suite of examples for automating this, like Terraform format. Don't just fail Terraform format. That's not user-friendly.
Well, so that's
Terraform format and commit back to the repository. So it's fixed. Developers would just have to pull again. That's especially easy if they're using something that automatically pulls those changes in the background, like VS Code with automatic pulling enabled, Git pod or GitHub codespaces. And yes, Terraform validate JSON is something that was on my mind.
I was wondering if this totally relates to the same thing, because now this gives context of how the validation failed according to Terraform. So that's pretty cool.
I am going to be looking at writing up a review doc action that's going to take it, because Terraform validate is one of those annoying examples where you actually have to look at the GitHub action output. You couldn't until 15 beta to take it out of there. So I couldn't easily get it out with review doc. And I'm seeing a couple of questions in chat. There is a similar tool for Kubernetes YAML. Yes. There is a validator that basically tells you if the YAML is valid for your Kubernetes version. That is kubevol. And it also, I think, has some best practices, but I'm not sure about that. And the other question is, how do you lock HadoLint or TFLint version? By default, the latest version is pulled. We got some pull requests that people were like, hey, we want to pin the TFLint version. And now, by default, latest is pulled. And if you want a specific version, you basically set TFLint version argument or something like that. Again, these are open source. I just created the actions because I needed them for a client of mine. You can contribute to them. You can use them. They're good. I mean, I'm using them in production, but they could always be better. So open source contributions are welcome. But as much as I love this discussion, we went very far away from the initial question.
What I'm struggling with is, who is ReviewDog? Like, there's no website. I can't Google them. Is it a company? Is it who's behind it?
ReviewDog is a project made by somebody whose name I cannot pronounce. If you click the actual ReviewDog, it's Habib Usaz, I think it's the Twitter username. I cannot remember names. That's it. scroll up. On the left, you have contributors. That's it. High up for Timbusa.
Okay.
So you can sponsor this project.
Yeah, no, very cool.
It's their project. They're working on it. I thought it has a bunch of contributors. But yeah, open source. Get involved. Sponsor your dependencies.
Yeah, that is cool. Thanks thanks for that background. So yeah, back on topic, as you were saying, yes. Vlad, what should we be doing?
I can actually share. So, oh my God, I don't want to get into this, but basically my job is helping companies move faster. And that started with infrastructure and Terraform and Kubernetes and moved into CTO roles and advisory roles. So constant high number of pull requests to me hints at something being not optimizing the culture. Is there time specifically allocated for code reviews? So a lot of people do sprints, they add whatever story points and things like that, but engineers don't have time in their schedule and in their daily work to actually review code. Or it's something that is seen as do it when you have some time. And that's on the team leaders to show that, hey, I'm busy, I'm doing code review. This is just as important as coding. People mentioned, stuff like Mergify, stuff like automatically having a rotation of people reviewing, automating all this is very, very helpful. But definitely work into your company culture that code review is just as important as writing code. Yeah. Also, it depends wildly on the company culture, how big the company is, but what also helps is having stuff like OPA, because I saw there was a question coming with OPA, like automatic validation. There was a presentation at HashiConf in last fall, I think, or something like that, where they were using OPA through ConfTest to automatically approve and review Terraform code, unless it was doing some very weird changes. So basically, are you just changing the EC2 instance type to something slightly bigger? That's okay. Are you trying to put in a 24x large and 100 instances? That's not okay. Basically, they are doing, you can move to doing post-merge code reviews as long as the pull request is not changing something very intense. Only seen internal implementations of this, but things like, oh, the code is being changed is under a very specific feature flag. This is going to get automatically merged in and approved because in our company, we have that high level of trust and we can do post reviews for getting that feature out of the feature flag. But yeah, this depends. And it's not only a tech problem that we can fix with cool projects.
Thank you, Vlad. I think it was interesting input there. Any other feedback on that?
It sounds like there's actually...
Sorry, if I may just comment quickly, one of the things we've done in our team is we designate like for a week somebody in the team that's going to take the hit.
Oh, okay. Mostly like almost like on-call rotation.
Yeah, like almost like on-call rotation. Actually, we also kind of tie it with an on-call for our own stuff. And that person, we all know, okay, this week you're going to be doing this. And it doesn't really mean that he has to review everything, but just has to make sure that it's looked at. And if he can't, for some reason, approve or anything, make sure that follow up with who can do it.
Case down can, yeah.
So that's just comment there.
Makes sense.
It sounds like there are two different, very different questions here. One is, how can I change my company's culture to prioritize code reviews better? And the other is, how can I get through more code reviews without throwing more labor at it?
I think it's a fair breakdown. I think that one is psychologically related to the other. The more tedious, the more time consuming an individual code review is, the less inclined an engineer is probably to perform it. So if engineers are almost able to just click, approve because everything's been addressed, maybe it'll be faster.
I think another missing thing here is with the way I see it, it's also a way for teams to communicate. Let's say you have people that are learning and people that are not. Yeah, there's a good way to communicate. It's okay, you should consider this, you should consider that. And it's also not just that person that's going to see it. It's the whole team that gets to see that if it's done correctly, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an effective way of communicating some of that tribal knowledge that's hard to convey maybe with automation. Cool. Well, I think that was pretty helpful for me. I think there were some interesting considerations there around how to approach this, boiling it down to increasing some of the automation, perhaps looking at ReviewDog, perhaps increasing the amount of stuff that can be automated and merged, perhaps considering post-merge reviews, perhaps having somebody on call whose job it is to ensure that stuff is getting merged, which may or may not be the project manager or some, you know, member of the team on rotation.
Yeah, I have one.
You have a different problem than we do. Your problem is merge reviews from the public. Our problem is merge reviews from within our own company.
Well, but I have that too.
We have both.
Yeah, we have both. Like, I mean, you know, we have, you know, maybe 10 different organizations we have pull requests across. And it's not done until they get merged. And it's very easy for developer, you know, because from a developer, you know, they're cranking out tasks. They want to get those tasks done, but it sometimes loses steam as soon as the pull request is open and they move on to the next task. And suddenly you have 7 PRs open that we got to go through.
Yeah. And it feels a little bit wasteful then when you also put a PR out there and then 20 or 30 days later, you have to go back to it, resolve merge conflicts, get back into the mental groove you were in to explain it. Or, you know, respond to things. So I like that quicker feedback cycle. It's just how to, like, maybe, I don't know if it's slowing down the number of PRs that are generated in aggregate or what the answer is, but this was all good feedback.
Yeah.
I just had one other, sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Matt. Sorry.
No, I was just gonna say I had a really quick comment that one of the things is changing your mindset about PRs just in general. Like, I think over my career, I've probably learned more about coding and interesting ways to write code and solve problems by reading other people's code than I have, like, from any other method of learning, PR out there. So, like, look at it as a learning opportunity. Whether you're, a junior dev or a very seasoned, like, you know, senior dev, you always have an opportunity to learn more things by reading other people's code. And even if you're not the one reviewing it, reading a lot of code will actually, you know, make you a better developer just in general. So I was just going to comment because we were talking about code reviews and PRs in general. That's all.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit inspired. I mean, so Andy was the one who asked it. And I mean, it's a little bit like on top of mind because you said, like, you know, you came from an environment where, like, somebody opens a pull request and you can get a review within seconds or minutes. And I haven't seen that happen for us consistently.
Yeah, that was more of a culture thing. Like, treat other people's, like, open PR requests as urgent requests so that you don't have all those things that Andy just sort of alluded to.
Yeah.
And I was going to follow up on just that bit, which is, you know, if a pull request is, you know, 7 days old, maybe it's 14 days old, then the person, you know, you can use, like, chat ops in that realm to just kind of, like, ping the people who are reviewers to remind them, like, hey, this thing is sitting out there. Because yeah, those PRs that go for 30 days and nobody's looked at them, you do get really screwed where, you know, I don't remember a code that I wrote 30 days ago. I know other people don't either. So it can be problematic to let those sit. And I feel like that's a thing that, I don't have a tool recommendation, but I think it's a smart thing to build some automation around because there's gotta be some tool who's doing that, like, you know, follow-up ping on a PR.
What you're saying there though, Matt, as somebody who's on our contributors group, how about those GitHub notifications, huh?
Yeah, we need to double those, you know? If a PR is out there for a year, maybe we need to start closing them. You know, that's when we need to go to.
Well, we have death by GitHub notification here. We have just too much activity with hundreds of repos and open source. All right, I do want to get to some other talking points here, though. So let's pause at that one. Let's get to a community question here. Actually, by you, Matt. Let's go to this one that you were asking earlier. I'm going to pull it up on my screen first before I Introduce it here. So Matt actually asked this question a couple weeks ago, or a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we
I
didn't
can give context if you want.
Let me just do a quick intro, and then anything that I add, we'll add to that. So this is a common problem that Matt talks about, especially for like environments where maybe you're working with telephony, situations where you have chat protocols, long-lived TCP connections that are in some way stateful. And maybe you don't always have control over the application code itself, that you can just make the protocol more resilient. So in talking about this in a more general sense, has anybody seen or tackled this kind of problem where you have your applications deployed, perhaps using WebSockets on Kubernetes? You have lots of, you know, maybe thousands of long-lived TCP connections, and yet you have a cluster that is scaling. You're doing new deployments. You are maybe you're on spot instances, and some of your instances are going away. Has anybody seen some kind of a smart TCP connection aggregator, or as Matt describes it here? Does anyone know if there's a network or a TCP proxy tool out there that will manage and forward these long-lived TCP connections in such a way that's less disruptive to the clients, the end applications? Matt, on that, what would you like to add? What did I miss?
It's an esoteric problem that has to deal with legacy clients. So I don't expect like many people to know about it. And I've just been striking out on trying to, you know, have anybody who's had any experience in this realm. So I don't think it's something.
It's a problem today. We have customers that use Twilio. Twilio has long-lived connections for voice. You don't want to kill that pod. There's an active voice conversation happening on that. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it is more generic of a problem than I think about it though. My thought is that, hey, if anybody has solved this or knows of some direction or even a term, I could start Googling.
Yeah. How do you Google this?
yeah, exactly. It's just one of those things where I want to solve something without writing something custom.
Yeah.
Or I want to solve this problem without writing something custom, but I keep hitting against a wall, and I feel like it's getting to the point where I'm just going to tell my client, like, hey, you know, let's write a really thin manage and forward TCP socket connection layer that we don't deploy often. And then the thing that actually does stuff with your TCP socket connection, you know, is the thing that you deploy often. And that way we're, you know, buffering those messages over the socket. That sucks. But if that's the way it needs to go, then that's the way it needs to go. But yeah, if anybody has any experience with this, feel free to ping me. We don't need to, you know, drown this call in that is one thing I'll mention.
When I used to work in at Electronic Arts, the game company, there's of course very long game sessions, and although I didn't manage those clusters, they were managed by other teams in the company, but they were all HAProxies, every single one of them.
Okay.
They were pool of HAProxy servers, and they did some crazy stuff with that. That was before Envoy, Kubernetes, and all that. So I know HAProxy can actually do some of that, but you will have to actually switch it over and put it on front of whatever you have right now to then move the connections over to the definite solution you are building, basically.
And conceivably, like a separate even pool of resources that outside of your main.
I mean, you actually have a couple of dangers here, right? I mean, one is that if you do something to leave the connection up all the time, you and even if it's not really up, you run the risk of like your application or your client application believing that the server side is available even when it's not. And I'm sure that leads to non-desirable situations and what we're talking about here. And then second is there like retry logic or something on the other side, or why isn't it just like when the connection gets dropped, it retries a bunch of times and reestablishes to the new pod that brings it up? Like that seems like a much simpler solution.
Just rewrite the whole thing in UDP. Get that.
I'm not suggesting that, but I have a lot of experience kind of with low level networking things, and When you try to fool, like, I mean, the whole idea is like when that drops, like when the when your server side drops, like in the TCP protocol, it's actually going to send like a reset, like an RST, right? Because the actual like packet is gone and that endpoint is no longer there. And that's actually what's like, it's behaving as intended. So you're trying to like circumvent what TCP's real job is doing, like somewhat in this case, right?
Yeah, and I they do reconnect. It's something where, you know, that does happen, but I think that it's you know, something that we've been trying to think about from the perspective of, we want to start doing, you know, for this specific client, I want to start doing you know, blue, green, or canary, and which means I'm going to be like swapping out connections a lot. And therefore those connections do have real world impact on the customers that are at the other end of that tunnel. Sure. So it's, yeah, I think that, you know, the connections will, you know, reconnect, and that's not the issue. It's just that it has ramifications on the actual applications capabilities that I was hoping that, you know, something that could live in the middle and manage that a little bit more intelligently would be the way to go.
So, and this is like more like on the category of terms to Google side, a pattern that I thought was really rad. The project has stalled out 2 years ago, so I don't think it's alive anymore. I got into this back in 2010, so almost 10 years ago, or maybe it was 7 years ago, maybe. Or not 10 years ago, sounds about right. Mongrel 2 was a re-implementation of Mongrel, the web server, in a very interesting pattern. And behind the scenes, it's using 0MQ as the message bus between the servers. And the job of Mongrel is simply just to ingest the data and stick it into ZMQ. And then you have consumers of ZMQ processing and sticking the response back into it. And yet it supports WebSockets and long-lived connections and things like that. Now, I don't know what, this is for specifically HTTP. You were saying TCP, I think, maybe. So I don't know if you were thinking HTTP over TCP or if ultimately it was just HTTP. Matt.
Yeah, it's just a TCP socket. So it's at like layer three or it's at layer four. Which makes it more difficult. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing I keep running into is folks are recommending things that are at like, you know, layer seven, like WebSockets. Yeah. It you know, when you're dealing with legacy client interfaces, it's just you don't have the control. But this is a good I'll look into that just from, you know, checking it in, like seeing if there's some follow-up to that project, because it seems like somewhat
similar. Or somebody may be solving the same kind of thing somehow through TCP. But I don't, the fact that you're, I mean, where you're trying to solve it at layer three, layer four, in a generic way, I don't see that happening to Matt's point there. The reason why these things are at layer seven is for that reason, that you are in control of the application logic.
Yeah, the only thing I know of that might help you a little bit would be, I know in Calico, as an example, they have this thing called a floating IP, I think, or something like that, where it basically presents a workload IP that it keeps alive all the time, and then like basically redirects it to the pod that hosts it. So like they do some sort of trickery under the hood where you have like a static IP address kind of in the cluster that gets then used to redistribute traffic to other pods in the cluster. So it might be something along those lines that might be able to keep it up, or, you know, do something like that.
I think that, yeah. So I was directed by an AWS solution architect to look into App Mesh, and App Mesh has an idea of virtual nodes, which sounds very similar.
Yeah.
That could be something I want to go down. I have to look into it more. The whole load balancer controller and service mesh discussion is one that I dug into, and it's painful as well. Anyway, thanks, folks. I think this was useful.
Cool. So I want to jump on to the next question here by David Lozano. He's asking, and it's a multi-part question that I broke out here. So we'll tackle the first one before we get to the second one. What are the key points you consider when deciding to deploy your workloads on ECS, what I call ECS Classic, or ECS on EC2, and ECS Fargate, which is the serverless version of ECS. So before I get to that directly, I just do want to point out, if you go to YouTube, we have a Cloud Posse Explains on ECS, on EC2 versus ECS Fargate on costs, where I think we cover a lot of these interesting topics. But yeah, let's see if anything new comes out of this right off the bat. One thing I'd like to point out is that, which was already raised, let me bring over the Slack conversation here. Some replies here by Darren Cunningham, which is like, yeah, a big one. Like when you're dealing with EC2s, you are responsible for the AMI and the OS and patching and updating that. You're responsible for the update of that EC2. And yes, day zero, day one, you brought that machine up quick. You're on EC2. Perhaps your costs are apparently lower because you're doing that. But the long-term cost of that, when you factor in the OS and patching and waking up on Christmas Eve to, you know, restore that server, maybe some of those things counteract the cost savings there. Other considerations for going the EC2 route is if you need to install like host hardening or OS level tools that are dictated by somebody outside of your pay grade, and you have no control over, then maybe you need to go the EC2 route. There are also a number of limitations on ECS Fargate, which you need to be aware of to determine which one way to go. Many of those have been addressed now. I believe you can use EFS, for example, with Fargate as well, and that wasn't possible for a long time. What are some of the pros and cons that you guys see between ECS on EC2 and ECS on Fargate?
I've flexed and just linked to my reInvent talk. Scaling speed also has an impact. This is usually apparent when you're running a bunch of containers, but Fargate can scale up usually faster and in a more cost-efficient way. But that depends on what metric you're scaling, what kind of CloudWatch math you have to do, how predictable that is, and so on and so forth. And also, I want to highlight the fact that what Darren said, Fargate has Spot, and Fargate Spot has really, really, really good pricing.
Yep, that is cool too. Which was, I mean, it didn't come out with Spot. It's a one of the relatively newer things.
Yeah. EKS on Fargate does not support Spot yet.
Yeah.
ECS on Fargate does support Spot.
Yeah, one of the other limitations I was going to say, and you just had it on that screen as you scrolled by it, is that it's not available in every region.
Okay.
So depending on where you are and where you need to run workloads, you might not actually be able to use Fargate.
This is from 2017, so these are some pretty old things here. All right, very cool. Also, I guess, well, on the ECS task size, could one say that that's a limitation when you're using Fargate, that you're limited to the maximum size of an ECS container?
Which is smaller than a Lambda container from a CPU perspective. So for Fargate, you can get up to 4 CPUs and 30 or 32 gigs of RAM. Okay. For Lambda, you can get up to 6 CPUs, which is a tiny bit embarrassing for Fargate. You also don't get GPU support right now. You don't get to pick ARM instances. You don't get dedicated network pipes. So if you're doing something that's network intensive, like 100 gigabit network pipe is required, you're going to pick EC2s.
Those limitations don't exist when you're on EC2s, you're saying?
You can tweak them. Yeah, you can get EC2s with GPU support. Using GPUs in containers, you cannot split a GPU, but you can use it in a very stable way. Yeah. You can get EC2s with dedicated network pipes and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So there you have it. I think that was a pretty good breakdown of some of the considerations, not focusing strictly on cost savings, but also some of the technical decisions to be aware of there. David, are you on the call?
Yeah, I'm here.
Any other question related to this question? We'll get to the next one in a second. Did we cover the key points there to consider? EC2 versus Fargate.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. You guys covered the most of the pros and cons on this decision making.
Okay.
For sure.
Let's get to the next one here. So, what would make you pick Fargate, even though it's more expensive when running the tasks 24/7? So this is, again, I think this highly relates to that YouTube video on comparing the costs. And when you factor in the human cost, when you factor in the opportunity cost, when you factor in all the other costs associated with this, I think one can make it, you can make a case for whatever you want to make a case for. In the end, what do you prefer to do, and then make it build a case for it? So
it makes sense. In this case, I prefer Fargate. I just wanted to have more elements to make that case.
More ammunition, to bring it up. I would say the biggest things there are what was mentioned there is that. If you amortize the human cost for you making and patching these updates, outages related to that, and the impact on those on business, and you factor that into the tens of thousands a year, I think you'll quickly see that the benefits are washed away.
Right, it makes sense for sure.
All right, so Andrew Roth, you had a question here. Built-in, what's everybody's thoughts here? So built-in pod security policies versus OPA. OPA is more work, but way more flexible. How do you choose between them? I don't have a opinion on it per se, other than an observation is that does it need to be mutually exclusive?
Yes, because pod security policies are going to be deprecated. I'm trying to find.
Yeah, I wasn't when I asked that. I wasn't aware that PSPs were going to be deprecated, so that made it real easy for me.
Wow, what is this inspired by? The stuff on OPA, is that why pod security policies are going away?
Yeah, I found a good link. I'll post in office hours from.
All right. Well, you heard it here first. No. That's cool. Well, all right. So that I guess that's answered then. So let's talk just, and this is a very quick one. I don't know how much we can really go into details on the call, but Bart Codens, who's listening or asked a question previously in office hours, like how to manage IAM users. And we kind of said, well, should you even be managing IAM users when you have AWS SSO? So the follow-up question here he has is, how do you manage then the users and passwords inside of Amazon SSO? And that's the thing, you don't. That's offloaded to your single sign-on provider. So if you're using Okta, if you're using G Suite or whatnot, what it is AWS SSO has a trust relationship with your identity provider. And then that's identity provider, that's your centralized source of truth for your users and their passwords. You never even have to deal with it.
Yeah, Eric, can I just interject here that you can actually use AWS SSO as your IDP as well if you want. There is a built-in user database.
Good
where
point.
you can also create users and passwords and set MFA policies and all that kind of stuff. Good there point. If you don't have an external IDP.
So I don't have an answer for that. Usually though, it is, usually in terms of customers we come into contact, has never come up that they prefer AWS SSO. They're going with an Okta type solution.
Or Google, Google Apps or something like that. It wouldn't be our recommendation, but it is possible to do that.
I usually try to resist, hybrid cloud just for the sake of hybrid cloud. But one of the ones I've seen that has been successful and gets used a lot is, if you're AWS, great. But Azure has their managed Active Directory that a lot of people like to use.
Yeah.
Yes.
You see that a lot more in enterprises that have a a Microsoft existing relationship already with Active Directory and that kind of thing. You know, there are pros and cons about it, but it works, and it works well.
All right, I am just reading through here. If there were any other questions posted,
the PSP, the pod security policy, whatever they call it, the admission controller or whatever is being officially deprecated in 1.22, which they said will probably be out in the summer. So, just in case anyone was curious, when
that's good context. Aha, Mohammed points out that Terraform 0.14.9 just dropped in the usual Wednesday cadence here. All right. I don't have any other questions. Anybody have any questions? Observations, announcements?
Spent some time looking at Helm charts recently because somebody was like, oh my gosh, this Helm chart's deprecated. You know, going from centralized to decentralized makes sense, but it seems like a lot of them haven't been picked up.
They haven't. There's a vacuum. I don't know what's gone on. Was it operator? So there's operator hub where you can try and find replacements. We rely a lot on Bitnami's charts, which they aren't the same ones that you would find in the official list, but they have their own analog or version of it.
Are they on the hub.helm.sh, which basically holds all the different repositories? I think that's the URL. I'm not sure.
No, it became Artifact Hub. So actually, that's what I was thinking of, not Operator Hub, but Artifact Hub.
I actually think every technology that's ever tried to get like a community built around it ends up having this problem. you look at Chef and Puppet and Terraform itself and all these things, like people build modules and it's all, modules, cookbooks, you know, whatever you want to call it, like for all these things. And it all depends on the level of dedication of the people who are supporting those things out there, of how well maintained they are. So there are clearly organizations that specialize in that, like Cloud Posse and others for Terraform. And, you know, but there are definitely just as many people who wrote a chart to solve their need, and everyone started using it, and then their need changed and it doesn't get the love and support that it used to. And it just kind of dies on the vine. So that's like, it seems like an age old problem that's just repeated itself over and over and over again throughout the years.
Yeah. I'd be interested to hear the collective wisdom here about like the, I can give an example of the actual problem I had today. There's a product called Metabase. So if you search Metabase here, you're going to find one chart back in Artifact Hub.
Yeah, sorry, this just was perfectly.
Describes. This graphic comes up so many times whenever NPM is talked about. It's like the perfect.
But yeah, Helm is a little bit the same way more and more. And like we depend on like the raw chart, and raw chart, like, you know, there's no authority for that anymore and whatnot. All right. So yeah, I love Metabase. What did you want? You want
to pull up? If you go to Artifact Hub and look for Metabase, there's one chart.
Okay.
It was in the Helm chart stable, but that's been deprecated. So what's the thought process here? Is it like, it's use the deprecated chart, use this chart from some dude who I've never heard of, or fork it and run it myself?
Use that chart from some dude you never heard of that installs containers that you've never looked at, that installs, you know, Bitcoin miners that you'll never notice. And I don't know. Yeah, no, it's an amazing web of trust we've built here, and not cryptographic trust. I don't have the answer for you. This is what we've been bit with Prometheus, right? We used to always recommend Prometheus Grafana as part of our solution. We started when it was this guy, Michael Goldband or something. I don't know, some guy at Ticketmaster, and then that went to CoreOS, and then CoreOS gave it to the community at Kubernetes Helm charts, and then that got shut down, and then it moved to the Prometheus community, and then Prometheus community decided to redo it. This is open source. And this is, I guess, why enterprise software is so expensive. It costs a lot to keep it up to date, and you don't have to deal with some of this stuff.
There was also a cool launch last week of S3 Lambda objects. I don't know if you'll discuss that.
No, what is that about?
It's man in the middle for S3 GET requests, and it's super fun. So basically, when you do a GET request to S3, instead of the request going to the object in S3, it would be intercepted by Lambda that would do whatever and return an object. Like, it can return the object, it can return something else, it can return a filtered object. Mm. So like, if you store an XML, you could have a Lambda that when you're accessing that object, you would return that XML converted to JSON or only part of that XML. Or if the object doesn't exist, you would return some default object or something like that. It's interesting.
Isn't it
meant to replace all the S3 proxies that people wrote?
Conceptually, it's also very similar to Lambda at Edge, no?
Yeah, that's funny. I was just about to say that. Yep, yeah. Same thing.
So this Lambda, Lambda, I don't know.
Lambda. That's a cloud.
This is full Lambda. So Lambda at Edge cannot use layers, cannot use extensions, can only run for something. This is full Lambda. So extensions, layers, all that goodness, 15-minute timeout and all that.
It can run Docker Lambda?
Similar. Yes, I think so.
Wow.
And it's also similar to actually having a Lambda and just invoking that Lambda. But this is going to be pretty useful for like legacy workflows that no S3, and you can just shove something in front of that instead of getting the permissions to invoke a Lambda, invoking the right version of that Lambda and all that.
Yeah, just another integration point. Cool. Any other cool AWS announcements that you've seen recently, Vlad?
They also reduced the pricing of Glacier, some type of Glacier request by 40%, the one that actually put objects in Glacier. All of these came out in AWS Spy Week, which was last week, because S3 is 15 years old, and they had a bunch of a tiny reInvent with talks and two fancy announcements.
Very cool. Well, thanks, Vlad, for speaking up and bringing that up. We are out of time for today, so I just want to start wrapping up here. I respect everyone's day. Please, if you haven't already subscribed to our YouTube channel, head over to youtube.com/C/CloudPosse and subscribe there. It helps us out a big deal. Also, go ahead and join our Slack team. If you haven't joined already, go to slack.cloudposse.com. We got 3,500 awesome people there helping each other out, and it's a really supportive community. Other things to point out, again, we are hiring, so do go over to cloudposse.com/jobs. Again, cloudposse.com/jobs if you're looking for your next big thing. Talk to you guys next week, same place, same time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, guys. Bye.